Welcome to Inspiring Stories for Bauer and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments because the little things are everything.
Hello, my name is Tim McMillan. Welcome to another episode of Inspiring Stories brought to you by Bauer and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments because the little things are everything. My guest in this episode is an absolute sporting legend in this state. It would not be a stretch, I don't think, to say that our most successful sporting team in the Perth Wildcats probably wouldn't exist without the efforts of our guest in this episode and other members of his family. He was the inaugural captain of the Perth Wildcats that has gone on to become, if you measure them by finals appearances at least, the most successful sporting team in the world, which is no small feat. So I'm looking forward to hearing about what was a really interesting and exciting time for sport here in WA, and it is absolutely beyond question that the Perth Wildcats are our most professional sporting team here in Western Australia. So lots to get through. Let's say hello and welcome to Mike Ellis. Hello, Mike.
Hello, Tim. How are you?
Going well, thanks.
Excellent. You're obviously short on the people that you can get in here, so you have to
not at
the
all
of the barrel.
Not at all. I don't know why it's taken us so long to get you in here for one of these chats, Mike.
Well,
obviously, you're a busy man. You're in demand.
Well, something like that. Yeah, yeah. Just working for a living sucks, though. You've got to do that, don't you?
Yeah, it can't be Friday night. The 1980s in Perth, you know, lifting trophies above your head and having thousands of people screaming your name.
Yeah, them were the days.
In a stadium.
Them were the days.
Good times. Let's start on the now, though.
Yep.
What are you up to now?
What am I up to now? I actually run a education supply company.
Yeah.
So when I finished with the Wildcats, I had to come up with a job because I had to actually earn a living.
Yeah.
And, you know, I went through the era where there wasn't a lot of money. So I didn't have this huge backlog of money behind me that I could just retire and swan around. So I had to actually
live the dream.
The dream, exactly. So I went in, and a previous coach of mine, who I'd known for many times, had a company that many viewers or many listeners would know, a company called Wooldridge's.
Yeah.
Now, Wooldridge's was pretty much had the monopoly on the school industry. And he said, look, come and work for me. And I went, mate, I'm not a rep. I'm not a salesperson. I don't know what. And he goes, no, it's all about relationships. You'll be good. So I said to my wife, look, I'll do this for 12 months until I find something else and work out what I want to do. Originally, I was in the building trade. I'm actually a wall plasterer by trade.
Is that
so
right?
There you go. So I've actually got a trade.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you don't have an education, get a trade.
When was the last time you plastered a wall?
A bloody long time ago, mate, I've got to tell you. But my theory was I didn't want to go back to that. My brothers were still doing it. But it's just a young man's gig, mate. It's just too hard.
And what about basketball? Is it still a big part of your life?
Yeah, very much. I find time for that. And a lot of people say, how do you fit all that in? I go, well, that's actually a release for me, you know, because you can't work all the time. You have to have something else to do, and you need a release. Now, family has always been my biggest release and my most important one. But basketball has been such a big part of my life for so many years. I still coach in the state league. So it was called the SBL. It's now called the NBL 1. So it's that tier down from the NBL. And so I still coach in that. Have done that for a number of years. I coach juniors. I help in the PSA, which is the Private Schools Association. So I help a little bit there at Christchurch. And I also coach the state schoolboys team. So, yeah, I do a
still
little
pretty
bit here. I know. When I say all that, I go, what the hell am I thinking?
That's
you know?
A lot. It sounds like a lot when you reel
crazy.
It off like that.
It's crazy.
The early 80s.
Yeah.
The birth of the Wildcats. I mean, before they were the Perth Wildcats, they had a different name, right? Tell me about, you know, growing up in a basketball family. Obviously, your brothers have been a big part of the story of the Wildcats, particularly in the early years. Obviously, your dad was a huge figure as well. But let's go back to the early 80s. You know, you're a young man, playing lots of basketball. It's in the blood, the Wildcats. How did it all come about?
Yeah, well, look, it was something that the Wildcats were started by the basketball WA Basketball Association.
Yeah.
So it started there and was owned by the club. So Basketball WA owned the Wildcats. They tried to get in. I was living in Melbourne in 79-80, and I went over there to improve my game and play because that was the best competition in the country at the time. There was no NBL. The NBL started in 79, but there was only four teams in it. And everyone was going, no, this is never going to work. As it started to get some impetus, it started to move. WA really wanted to get in, and it looked like we were going to make it in 1981. So I left Melbourne and came back because I had opportunities to play for other clubs across the country. But my view was always, if I'm going to play in the NBL, I want to represent WA. I'm a WA boy, and that's what I wanted to do. So I came back here. We didn't make it in 81, but we got in 82, and that was the start of it. Now,
why didn't you get in 81? You just weren't quite ready for it?
No, it wasn't us. It was them.
Right. Yeah.
Back then, Tim, the biggest thing was that no one wanted to travel to WA.
Yeah.
You know, it's too far.
They're
why
still
would
reluctant.
We go all that? Well, they are. Well, they're not allowed to at the moment, are they?
That's very true as well.
But it's more we don't want them, really. It seems to be the scenario. But teams didn't want to travel. So we had some caveats on us to actually make it into the league. So there was a couple of things we had to do. The first thing was that for the first 3 years of the league, we as a club had to pay an extra $45,000 per year. Now, back in 82, 45 grand was a lot of money.
Mm.
So we had to pay that on top of everything we did. And that was to subsidise other teams to travel to WA.
Yeah, right.
So we had to do that. So that was the first thing. That was the only way they'd let us in. And the other way was we were the only team in the league that would play triple headers. So we'd go and play on a Friday night away, say in Melbourne, a Saturday night in Hobart, and a Sunday night up in Brisbane, and then fly home Sunday night. And then, you know, all of us were working, mate. We weren't getting paid anything. We were full-time workers. So
so you're plastering walls during your days?
Absolutely.
While all this is happening?
So we're 12 hours on the tools and then go and train at night for 3 hours, you know. And people don't realise that. They don't understand it. Mate, I would have killed to be able to go down during the day and get up 150, 200 shots, go and lift weights, do all that sort of stuff. We never did any of that. So.
Yeah.
When you think back to what people accomplished during their time, when they're actually working a full-time job to do it, and, you know, I mean, look, a lot of the women's teams have to do that. They still do that to this day.
Mm.
So I really empathise with them too, because it's not easy when you're doing that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
But we got in and we started. And the team originally was the senior state men's team. So West State, Wildcats.
Yeah.
And there was a competition to name the Wildcats. And that's what happened. So it came up.
Massive shift
to
Perth Wildcats.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It was huge. Minor logo change, and that was about it. But
do you remember the first game?
I do
indeed. As the Wildcats,
totally.
As part of the NBL?
Yeah, I think it was, 6th of February.
Huh.
1982 at Perry Lake Stadium.
Yeah.
We played the Geelong Supercats, who had Cal Bruton and James Crawford.
Handy.
Yeah, and they kicked
you obviously
liked
the look of them because
they were good. Yeah, we ended up
kind
of kept our eye on them. So we got our butts handed to us by about 30, I think, in that game. It was but still vividly etched into my mind. But you know the thing, Tim, for me, the biggest thing that really sits in my mind about that was we're playing at Perry Lakes, and you'd walk in, and Perry Lakes held about 800 people. It was pretty chockers. And it was great because it was full. You know, I used to always joke that we'd play in front of Perry Lakes, 800 seats, no bugger in them and all that sort of stuff. But that's not true. It was actually full. But the thing that really is etched in my mind is that when I walked into that stadium for the first game, first was, wow, check this out. This is real, you know, to have this many people here. But more importantly, I could have named just about every single person in that stand.
Is that right?
Yeah, because... Yeah. We just, they were basketball people. They were there.
Family.
They were people I knew. Yeah. They were people that I'd played against, I'd played with, I'd, you know, been involved with in some capacity in the sport. So it was such a tight family unit, even in the crowd. And that was something that I think has been lost over the years just purely because of size. You know? But it was so intimate back then. And, you know, it was just fantastic to be part of that and feel like...
Mm.
It was kind of history in the making to play that first game and then be a part of it. And then reality set in when we got our butts kicked.
To say, though, that the people of Perth embraced the Wildcats would be an understatement. They wouldn't. My memories growing up, you know, I was of that age, getting into my teens as the 80s started to roll through.
Stop making me feel old.
Sorry. It's not often I get to do that. Often I'm happy to explain, you know, I'm in your position. You know, the primetime TV, it was massive. Obviously, we didn't have an AFL team, or an AFL comp then.
No.
So there was no Eagles, let alone Dockers, on the horizon. But
The way that people in Perth got behind the Wildcats being in this national competition was pretty special, wasn't it? And the growth that you experienced through that time in the 80s was extraordinary.
Oh, it was. It was ridiculous. It just kept going and going and going. And you know, the early days were a bit tougher, for obvious reasons. I mean, we just didn't have the money. We didn't have the money to bring in the high-powered imports and all that sort of stuff. And it was very much just the locals and a few imports, you know, we'd bring in from time to time. We got some okay ones, and then we had a few issues with some other ones where, you know, they started to play and then they disappeared for various reasons, which we may talk about later on, I'll see. But, you know, it was difficult for us, and really it was all the local guys that were doing the job. And we just needed to get some impetus and get some extra ability there. So the local guys were holding their own, but we were always beaten by imports on the other sides.
The likes of
James Crawford, Cal Bruton, and those sorts of guys.
But how tricky was it in those early years to get those big names to a new comp and a new team in a new comp?
Totally. Well, the most difficult thing was we didn't have the money.
Yeah.
You know, because we're paying this extra money to just be in the league. You know, and it wasn't like, you know, 800 people at the stadium, and they weren't getting charged massive money to come in either. So it's not like they were making money. In actual fact, the club was probably hemorrhaging money. So they didn't have that extra finance to pay for the big imports that they needed to bring in. And that's why we kind of struggled along for those first few years. It wasn't until the change and suddenly it became an ownership. Checkbook, all those sorts of things.
Things started to happen.
Yeah.
Which we'll get into right after we take a break. Mike Ellis, the inaugural Wildcats captain, is our special guest in this episode. Two-time NBL champion, and the list of accolades goes on. But I can tell you, right after we take a break, Mike, we're going to have a little trip down memory lane and hear some of your finest work behind the mic.
I know where this is going.
You know what's coming, don't you?
Yeah, I do.
Oh, what a moment. What a moment that was. And you know, it's still got legs, hasn't it?
I know.
It's like people love it, even now.
They still roll it out.
They're so bad, it's so good.
It is, exactly.
Yeah.
Cringeworthy.
What a moment of musical genius that was. Anyway, we'll hear that. Maybe not in its entirety.
Good, thank you.
In part, at least.
Thank you.
Right after we take a break. This is Inspiring Stories. Back with more in a moment.
You're listening to Inspiring Stories for Bowra and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments, because the little things are everything. Inspiring Stories for Bowra and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments, because the little things are everything.
Tearing up the car and building up the heat. Here we come. Oh no. Here we come. Oh no. Here we come. Yeah, but Wildcats are on the prowl. Watch out if you're in the way. Listen to the hiss, listen to the growl. The Perth Wildcats are on the prowl. On the prowl. Yeah, the Perth Wildcats are on the prowl. On the prowl. Listen to the bats, you know we're gonna pounce. Perth Wildcats are on. Can you feel the chill? We're moving for the kill. Firing up the crowd and scoring points at will. Here we come. Oh no. Here we come. Oh no. Here we come. Yeah.
Welcome back to Inspiring Stories. That takes you back, doesn't it?
Oh yeah, thank you very much for that.
I'm not a body language expert by any means, Mike, but if I had to read you right now, I'd probably just say... Make it stop is what I was reading from you. Just turn it off, please.
Lucky there's no pencils close by, because I'd be stabbing them in my ears right now.
what a moment.
The part that where it says the Perth Wildcats are on the prowl, oh no, is good. Because I'm like, oh no, please, that's enough. Seriously.
Should have cut it there.
There's
so much
love. A lot of
that
views
stuff.
On YouTube, heaps, I can tell heaps. You that. Heaps of views.
I mean, it ticks every box. It's nostalgic, it's parochial.
Yeah. Oh, it's
low, it's WA, it's cringy, it's so bad, it's good.
Yeah, that's right, exactly. It's one of those things you just can't look away. It's like a car crash, isn't it? You just can't look away from it.
But honestly, how does that even happen? I mean, it's Perth in the 80s, so let's be honest, some crazy stuff happened in Perth at that time.
Yes, it did.
But how does someone come along and just go, fellas, we're doing a rap song?
Well, I think somebody was clearly on something at the time, which they weren't sharing. But that was actually written by Paul Kuiper, who was one of our players.
Right.
So he was the... Yeah, serious skills. Well, We were trendsetters, Tim, because we did rap before rap was rap. You know, yeah. Realistically, you know, it was a little bit of rap in
or
the
whatever
States,
that was.
Whatever that was, yeah. We'll say it was rap. Put a C in front of it, you might be half right, actually. But yeah, so he put it together, and then the worst part of all that was actually filming it.
Yeah.
Because we're trying to film it, and you've got guys that have rhythm, and you have guys that don't have rhythm.
Eric Watterson.
Okay, my hand up. I suck. I'm terrible. I have zero rhythm. Watto's probably in the negative, so, you know, that's okay. But they had to do all this filming. But cute fun fact, the filming, if you look at the video properly, you'll see a part where we're passing the ball from player to player
goes on. There are many passes in that
there's
sequence.
Lots of players, you know. Well, we actually stopped. So where I did my part, so myself, Tiny, James possibly, we were in the city.
Yep.
So we stopped traffic in Barrack Street and Murray Street and all that. And so we had cops there holding up traffic and detouring traffic all around. I mean, it was a prelude to what we do now, isn't it? It's how we live. We detour everywhere in Perth. But that's roadworks. So we were stopping traffic to make that. So it was good. But then doing all the filming in the locker room and all that sort of stuff and them trying to get us to move. We're going, mate, this is it. You know, this is what you
this
got.
This is as good as I've got for you.
And they didn't have Photoshop anywhere near as well as they do now. So you got what you got.
I suppose that was indicative of where you were at, though, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, the Razzle Dazzle had arrived.
Yep.
You guys were very much on the big stage. You'd started your extraordinary run of finals campaigns. Can we just backtrack a bit to that, though? Because we've sort of glossed over those years, you know, 82 leading through 87. Obviously, you know, you've found your feet in the national comp. Things are going well. The culture around the club's starting to transform. But along the way, you lost your dad as well, Gordon, who was such a pivotal figure in the early story of the Wildcats. Tell me about that time.
So that was 87.
Yep.
So 87 was a very interesting year. It had its highs and it had its lows. That was the year that, in 86, Bob Williams was a sponsor, and then he liked it, a bit like the Remington man.
Mm.
I was listening to someone on the radio, they were trying to work out who that was, and I nearly rang up and said, it was the Remington man. He liked the company so much he bought it.
Yeah.
So he bought it, and, you know, we had some long conversations, Bob and I, about what we needed to do, and I said, well, the first thing you need to do is get your checkbook out. Which is what he did. And so he brought in Cal and he brought in all these other guys and all that. And we went out to the public. So we were out at shopping centres. We'd take basketball rings out to shopping centres. And people were looking around like, what the hell is this stuff? They had no idea what it was. So we would do that. We would go out and we'd play in country tournaments and stuff. And just before the season started, we went and played an inter-team scrimmage down in Mandurah. And we went and played there. It was a great game. I think one of the teams won on the buzzer or something. It was pretty exciting. We're driving home, and I had my dad in the car, and my dad said to myself and my brother Glenn, he said, look, he said, I can't believe how exciting this season looks like it's going to be. He said, I can't wait to watch you guys. He said, you've struggled all through these last seasons, worked your tails off, never made playoffs. He said, I can see you guys going all the way with this team. You know, it's going to be fantastic. I can't wait to watch the season unfold and how it goes. That was on the Saturday night. On the Sunday morning, he went up to his local tennis club, which he started, Nolimara Tennis Club, went up and was playing Pennants tennis, and he died on the court the next day. So that
just
was...
massive heart attack.
Massive heart attack. I got a phone call. They said, Mike, you need to come up here quickly. So I drove up, thought this isn't good, drove up to the tennis court, and there was a sea of people there. And as I walked up, they just parted. It was like the Red Sea just parting. And as they parted, they opened up, I saw him lying on the ground, on the court. And his best mate was performing CPR on him, which he did from there all the way to the hospital. And I rode with him in the ambulance, and he never gained consciousness. So he passed away. That was a week before my wedding.
Oh, God.
And 2 weeks before the season started.
Wow.
So, yeah, I've never forgiven him for that. You know? How dare you do that, mate? What poor timing, you know?
Yeah.
So how
do you pick yourself up from a shock like that?
Well, I mean, that was so difficult. Obviously, our first thought was, well, we're cancelling the wedding, you know, and all that. And then wife was
and
like...
And you did?
No, hell no.
No?
No, we did not. My wife's like, oh, we've got it. You can't do it. I went, no. I said, you know what? I can see Dad looking at me going, you dare cancel that because of me, you mongrel. Don't even think about it. You do what you need to do. It was one of the, I mean, obviously it was my own wedding, but it was one of the most emotional weddings I've ever been to.
I can imagine.
Highs and lows and people, the speeches were just phenomenal, and it was amazing. And, you know, I'm still married to my lovely wife to this day, and we still remember that fondly. You know?
Yeah.
But that was hard, you know, going through that. It was really, really tough. And then we had the season. So we dedicated the season to Dad. That was basically Bob Williams decided that he would name the MVP award after my father based on that. So the MVP for the Wildcats is the Gordon Ellis Medal,
yep.
Which my mother, who's still alive and still going, her and I go and present that award to the winning recipient every Wildcats awards dinner each year. And we've
Fantastic.
Done that for the last 30-something years,
yeah,
you know. So that's fantastic. So
that's
legacy. What happened with Dad.
Yeah.
And that was just such a hard thing, you know. So he never got to see us.
It's such a shame, isn't
it? Yeah, it totally is, you know, because he was a massive part of it all.
But he called it. He knew it was coming.
He did. He called it, yeah, on the way home, you know.
Yeah.
And, so it is what it is. So it's one of those things that, you know, he was old school. We're trying to work out if he had any signs or was there anything he could have done. Could he have got checked up? You know, but who knows? You just don't know.
It just sometimes happens that way.
Yeah, correct.
It?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Exactly.
On the court, obviously things are starting to turn around. Performances are getting you into the the finals mix. How important was it? I mean, you talked earlier about the struggles getting some of those big names and, you know, having to front up and play against the likes of Cal Brute and James Crawford. You started to be able to attract some of these big names to the club. And I think with it came some of that razzle-dazzle that, you know, it took the presentation of the club, if you like, the way that you were able to present yourself to fans and to the comp and to the world, you kind of went into another level then, didn't you?
Yeah, no doubt, no doubt. And look, that 99% of that was down to Cal Bruton.
Yeah.
You know, he is the consummate showman,
yeah.
No question about it. You know, love him or hate him, you know, and, you know, people are divided on that.
You reckon they're still divided on that?
Yeah, I think so.
As they discuss his legacy?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, definitely. But, mate, Cal was the consummate showman.
Yeah.
He bought it. I mean, that was his catchphrase for 87 was run and stun and have some fun. And that's what we did. That was it. We had it on the back of our singlets, our training singlets. And that's what we did. We played that up-tempo style, flary game, which was fantastic. It was fun to watch. You know, the crowds got involved and it was the place to be.
Mm.
You know, it was the thing to go to. It wasn't this restaurant or that bar or that club. It was the Wildcats.
Absolutely.
And that's what happened. And I still have people today that say to me, we used to race home to watch it on the TV and, you know, all that sort of stuff. On a Friday night, we'd race home. And because it was on 7 and Kerry Stokes owned 7, he also owned GWN.
Mm.
So it was actually beamed across the state, not just the metro. So, you know, we had everybody behind us watching and like anything, Tim, as you well know, people like winners.
Absolutely.
They don't like losers, you know. So the fact that we were flary and exciting and enjoyable to watch and we were winning, it's a pretty good combo.
Yeah, unbeatable.
Yeah, very much.
And you've ridden that wave for 35 or so years now, which is pretty extraordinary. There have been a couple of times along the way as well, which have been controversial and again, sad in their own right. So maybe we'll get into that right after we take a break. I'm talking, of course, about one tiny Pinder and also the passing of Scott Fenton, which was, again, sudden and incredibly tragic. This is Inspiring Stories. Mike Ellis is our special guest. We'll be back with more and no more rap music right after this.
You're listening to Inspiring Stories for Bowra and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments because the little things are everything. Inspiring Stories for Bowra and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments because the little things are everything.
Welcome back to Inspiring Stories. My special guest in this episode is none other than Mike Ellis, the inaugural captain of the Perth Wildcats from their birth in 1982 all the way through until 1992. Two
player, correct.
Two premierships along the way, over 300 games. Mike, 1989, things are really, really going beautifully for the Wildcats. You hadn't won your maiden NBL title just yet, but along the way, I mean, a huge loss within the ranks. Scott Fenton, just to refresh people's memories, tell us what happened.
Yeah, so Scott came over, I think in 89, actually. We recruited him over. He was from Sydney originally and
yep.
been playing over there. Great player, great guy. He had his fiancée with him, Tina, who came, and she was playing for the women's version of the Wildcats, which was the Breakers at that stage. So yep. we recruited them both to come over, and they played for both of the teams. As I said earlier on, Scott was still working for a living. He was, you know, doing some, I think he was doing insurance salesman. So I should have known I shouldn't have trusted him at that point. but he was doing some of those things, just, you know, not a lot, but he was just, he wanted to get his feet in the door to that kind of industry so that when he retired as a player, he had something to go to, which was a smart thing to do.
Yeah.
So a lot of those calls were done after hours. So he and Tina had gone to visit a client in Sorrento or just up the road in Hillary's on a Sunday night, I think it was. And he was leaving the thing at about probably 11:30, 12 o'clock at night to go home. He pulled out of the street in onto Marmion Avenue. And unbeknownst to him, it was kind of on a little bit of a bend. Unbeknownst to him, there was two cars drag racing.
Yeah.
Along Marmion Avenue with their lights off. So he didn't see the lights coming around the bend. He pulled out as the cars came around the corner and they cleaned him up. And he died immediately. And Tina died, because I've spoken to people that were on the scene afterwards. She died sometime later, but still in the car. They hadn't even got her out of the car. So he died and she died almost not long after him. So to lose both of them like that was just
shocking.
You know, in that yep. sort of, and,
yeah.
you know, people say it's an accident. That's not an accident.
No.
You know, that's totally.
Just yeah, absolute. I mean, just totally, so I would say it, it's
yeah, yeah.
sheer reckless stupidity is an understatement, isn't
totally,
it? It's just
totally
reprehensible,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. But, of course, I didn't. And here's an interesting point is where I currently live now, I live in Sorrento. Where that happened is probably 500 metres up the road.
Is that right?
Yeah, from where.
So
it's just, so it's a constant reminder.
Into, yeah.
Yeah, constant reminder. You drive by and go, oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
But I obviously didn't know at the time, but Alan Black was coaching at that stage.
Yep.
I was still captain. So I got a phone call from him Monday morning at about 5 a.m. And I'm like, what the hell is Alan ringing me at 5 for? Mm. So I answered the phone after I'd woken up a little bit. And he told me the news, and I was I remember sitting there on the edge of the bed, just dumbfounded. And my wife woke up, obviously, because she'd heard the phone, and she's like, what? And it took me 5 minutes to actually enunciate to her what had happened. And it was just such a shock, you know. It was just one of those avoidable things that should never have happened, and it did. And it just killed us because he was a great – he was a great guy, really good guy. Take the basketball side away, he was a good basketball player, a fantastic teammate, but he was just an awesome guy.
Yeah.
And so was Tina, his fiancée. She was gorgeous as well. And to lose people like that, it's criminal. You know, yep. It really is criminal. It's just such a shame.
Did you have the job as the captain of the team to go and tell your teammates to deliver
basically.
That news?
Yeah, Alan and I went and had to get him together.
How do you do that?
Oh. I don't know. I still don't know how I did it, how we talked about it. It was, and I remember going down that road saying this has happened, and just the looks on everyone's face was just, it was almost like, oh, cut it out, you know.
Yeah.
That's a warped joke. Don't be saying that sort of stuff. You know, it was that hard to believe.
Disbelieving.
Yeah, yep. Yeah, total. So, yeah, that made that very, very difficult. It made the season. So, you know, we clearly dedicated the rest of the season to Scott. And the Breakers did the same for Tina, and we had a memorial. We had it at Challenge Stadium, which was called the Superdrome back then.
Mm.
We had it there, and I still remember coming in. The court where we were playing was set up. The baskets were actually left up there as a tribute sort of thing. But we had two massive photos, probably not life size, but probably half life size, one of Scott and one of Tina, and we had the memorial service there for him. And that was hard. That was very hard. And then we had to play that week. You know, we had a game that weekend, you know, and that was, you know, trying to get your head around that.
Which, again, is no doubt what he would have wanted.
Totally, yeah. Totally.
How did you go?
Yeah,
do you remember how you went in that game? Was it hard to
compartmentalise
as you would have needed to do?
No, that's a blur. The rest of that season was, well, the next month was probably a blur.
Yeah,
you know, we were kind of on autopilot almost, you know, because everything you did, every time you went in the locker room, it reminded you of him.
And,
and the Wildcats ended up retiring his singlet in as a tribute. Now, you know, singlets get retired for people that have done a lot of stuff over a long period of time.
Like your own number six.
Yeah, I'm fortunate enough to be one of those. just means you're old, is what it means. But Tim, he had only been with a club for a very, very short period of time, but he'd made such an impact on everyone. And the way this happened, that the club decided that that was a tribute that they wanted to make. So his was the first singlet. So if you go to the entertainment or the arena now, if you go to the arena, you'll see the singlets in order of retirement. His is the first one hanging up.
Right.
I'm next to him. I'm fortunate to be next to him. So I feel proud that mine was the first retired player to be retired. But it's next to Tim, next to Scott. And that I feel pretty good about that as well, you know.
Yeah, good place to be.
Yeah, it is. It is. And his parents were fantastic people. And every time we went and played in Sydney, they would always come and watch us play. And we would always catch up with them after the game. And that, for the next 3 or 4 years, that was just still so emotional every time we saw them.
Mm.
You know, it was amazing. It was just something that was so impactful. And in a bad way, but in a good way.
Well,
you
were
know
his,
what I mean.
You no doubt became his family away from his...
Totally. Yeah.
His family in Sydney.
Completely.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, so it's a special place that you guys have in, you know, in his memory to his mum and dad, no doubt. Whole different kind of drama that happened around... I mean, couldn't be more different, really. I have to ask you about the Tiny Pinder scandal. Which sort of just landed like a hand grenade, didn't it, in 1990? And there's this story, and I'm not sure where the story ends and the myth begins, or maybe it's all accurate, but the cops are waiting for him at halftime during a game, correct?
Yeah. So I probably let the cat out of the bag a little bit with this. I was doing an interview not so long ago when we're talking off air about it.
Right.
And it came up in conversation, sort of thing. And
it must, though, right? I mean, it's hard not to. The Wildcat story that people are still.
It's part of the legacy of the Wildcats.
Yeah.
It's what it is. You know, not all legacies and backstories for anything are all good.
Mm.
You know, there are bad ones.
Mm.
So it came up in conversation, and I said, "Well, I'm not going to talk about that on air." And they went, "Why not?" I went, what are you talking
about?
Should
we delete this bit?
I'm like, what are you? They said, "Why? Is it factual?" I went, "Yeah, well, it's factual." They go, "Well, you know, it's nothing." So I went, all right, well, look, I'm not going to expand on it, but I'll briefly touch on it.
Sure.
And I did. Well, from there, clearly.
It's grown legs again.
It's out.
Yeah.
It's out there and all that. So I feel a bit, I suppose I feel a bit bad that I brought it out.
Yeah. Having said that, you would have been one of several witnesses to this, right?
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally. Yeah. But it was kind of one of those things you didn't really talk about.
Yeah.
Just recently, more has surfaced, which is, again, sad. I was trying to get engaged by a investigative journalist, was trying to engage me into it. I wasn't at the time, I was actually trying to recruit his son. And I'm like, I don't think it's appropriate for me to talk about this now when I'm trying to recruit his son. It's not fair on him.
Yeah.
So I declined to do anything on that. but, yeah, the story basically goes that we're playing in the grand final series in 1990. And we come in at halftime. We're playing at home. We come in at halftime, and there's police officers waiting, and they handcuff Tiny in the room. And we kind of like looking at that. Go,
so
this
what
is
happening?
This isn't quite the halftime speech I was expecting. Anyway, long story short, we actually spoke to the officers and they allowed him to play the second half. I said, well, where's he going? He's not going anywhere.
How did he
go
in that
be
second
here.
Half?
Well, that's the, not funny, but the crazy thing about it, he was unbelievable in
Is
the second
right?
half. He had like 18 points, 15 boards in the second half. And you're just like, how do you go from that to do that, to perform at that level after that, whether or not he just thought...
He thought this might be the last half I play for a while.
Quite possibly, you know. They did have officers set up around all the doors in case he chased the ball down the road and ended up going down Wellington Street. So they did that. But yeah, it was one of those surreal moments, really surreal moments. And because we had no idea about any of this. And
as you reflect on it, so I know, tell me if I'm, again, digging too much here, but was it a bit of showboating or grandstanding by the police to come and do that in such a public way, halfway through a game? It's a scene out of a movie, isn't it?
It is. I don't think it was public in as much as they didn't do it on the court.
No.
They did it in the locker room.
Sure.
And to their credit, they said, all right, well, look, we'll let him play. And it wasn't brought out public. So I think they were doing their job. They'd got told, hey, you need to go and arrest this guy, and we've got to talk to him or all that sort of stuff. So they went and did it. It just happened to be, the timing was, we're in the middle of a playoffs game, you know. So it was what it was. And we had no idea. And afterwards, we kind of met. And it went for a little while where, Kerry Stokes, who owned the team at the time, spoke to us and said, look, you know, we're going to find out what's going on, and we don't know what's going on. Obviously, we'll back Tiny as best we can and give him the most support we can and all that. But at that stage, again, none of us knew what was going on.
You had no idea really what was happening?
No, not really.
Yeah.
Not really.
Incredible.
Yeah, it was. And then as it all unfolded, you start to go, oh, okay, righto, I can understand that, or I... You know, and obviously none of us condoned any of what he did.
No,
they were
incredibly serious allegations.
They were. But with anything like that, he still played with us for the next couple of years because it takes that long for the justice system to actually roll along and before he went to court and all that. It wasn't until later on that he finally went to court. So in the meantime, you know, you're innocent until proven guilty, and that's basically what happened. So he continued to play, and play very well for us. But there's two sides to Tiny. There was the off court side that none of us were really that privy to. I mean, look, he was a player. Don't get me wrong. He was out there, and you know, he had that in him. He wanted to kind of play the field a little bit and
live that life,
which was never something that I was ever interested in. I have trouble keeping one woman happy. How am I going to keep more than one? So, but when it started to come to light, you kind of went, oh. But then there was the on-court side of him, and Tiny was a phenomenal teammate, a fantastic teammate. And I knew if ever I got into a blue on a court, he would be the first guy there backing me up, you know, and that was the kind of guy he was. And that was the Tiny I like to remember. I do not like the other side of it.
Yeah.
And that side, and I certainly don't condone it or anything like that. It's just wrong what he did, and he paid the price for it. As he should.
Totally. And we'll put a full stop on that.
Yeah, done.
And we'll take a break, and we'll speak no more about it for the time being. Anyway, we need to take a break. Inspiring stories in this episode with Mike Ellis. We'll talk more about Wildcats and maiden victories right after this.
You're listening to Inspiring Stories for Bowra and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments because the little things are everything. Inspiring Stories for Bowra and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments because the little things are everything.
Welcome back to Inspiring Stories. Tim McMillan is my name. My special guest is Mike Ellis, inaugural captain of the Wildcats, a two-time championship winner. We've spent a bit of time dwelling on some of the unfortunate, in a broad sense of the word, chapters in the Wildcats history through the late 80s into 1990, but some absolute triumphant times as well. And you guys were just the absolute rock stars of Perth, weren't you? I mean, yourself, Tiny that we've mentioned, James Crawford, Trevor Torrance, Cal Bruton, a very young Ricky Grace.
Yes.
By this point, Watto, you know, you guys were the most recognisable faces in Perth.
Well, it was the hottest ticket in town.
Yeah.
That's for sure. I remember that first year in 90 when, we were playing at the Entertainment Centre and you had people lining, lapping the Entertainment Centre to buy tickets to come to the games, you know. So that was, it was kind of a bit surreal.
Yeah.
It was. You kind of didn't look at yourself along those lines, but that's what it was like.
You know? And there's some great footage of you hoisting. I mean, it's an impressive trophy in itself, isn't it? I mean, it's
I want
towering.
I want some royalties on that thing, mate, because
that photo. I mean, it's become one of the iconic
shots
for WA sport, hasn't it? You holding that massive trophy above your head.
Yep.
And you can just see the energy in the room. I mean, you could power the city with that. Yeah. It was enormous.
Yeah, it was purely adrenaline at that point.
Yeah.
Because when I was lifting it, I thought, geez, this thing's a lot heavier than I thought it was.
It's pretty heavy, isn't it? What was I thinking?
Yeah. That was just a spur of the moment thing. You know, when I got it, I think the elation of finally getting a championship and all that sort of stuff. And I'd never done anything like that before as far as lifting trophies up, and I'd seen people lift them up, so I figured that's what you got to do. I didn't realize that normally they lift up the small ones. I just lifted the big one up, but you're right, it is, it's an iconic photo. I'd like a dollar for every time it's been used somewhere in print or TV or whatever. I'd probably retire, I wouldn't be working, see, I'd be laughing. It was good, and just that was 9 years in the making. So that's why I think for me it was just such an elation to be able to do that and pick it up. And you know, there's clearly a heap of backstory around all why and how the championship came to fruition and all that. And you know, we talked about 87 where we made it to the grand final and we lost to Brisbane, and it was in Boondall, which is a place out of Sydney, out of Brisbane, about 30 minutes out of Brisbane. You know, 14 or 13,000 people and all that sort of stuff. We lost that. And I remember saying at that time, I never want to feel this way again, ever. You know, if we ever make another grand final, we're not going to lose it. And coincidentally enough, we played Brisbane in Boondall in 90 to win it.
Yeah.
So it was, you know, deja vu. And then
symmetry to it.
Yeah. And to get to it, we had to beat North Melbourne in the semi. And the two previous years, so 88 and 89, we lost to North Melbourne in the semi-finals and to not make the grand final. And then we played them again in 90 in the semi-finals, and everyone went, oh, God, here we go.
I hated North Melbourne.
Me too.
Scotty Fisher.
Yes.
It took a lot for me to embrace him when he came over.
I couldn't stand him
when he played for North
Melbourne.
Exactly.
He was the sort of guy you hate.
Because he was so good.
That's right. You love to hate him, but when he was on your side, you go, actually, that's pretty good. I'm okay with him now. So to get to the grand final, we had to beat these guys, you know. And the little backstory, in the 89 year, we lost game three by 55 points. How do you get to game three and lose it by 55? That's
a bad time in the office.
That's ridiculous. Ridiculous. But Cal Bruton played in 55, and he saw that as a sign, and that's when he retired as a player.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's why he retired.
Yeah.
That was it. So, yeah, winning that one in 90, that was just phenomenal.
Incredible.
So, you know, all that stuff, all that emotion just came out when I got the trophy, and I just went, hell, hang it, I'm lifting this thing up, you know.
There's a lot of build-up.
Yeah.
A lot of build-up.
Was.
You managed to back it up towards the tail end of your playing career.
Yes.
How did it go second time around?
Very different.
Yeah.
Very different because we had a different coach.
Yeah.
Murray Arnold came in. So we went from the run and stun and have some fun and play that up-tempo, exciting style of game to this dire, dour, boring as anything style of play, which was really defensive, you know. But it was effective. We won. We won that as well. So we went back-to-back. And then 92, I reckon we could have three-peated, but Murray had some ideas that didn't quite sit with me and didn't sit with some other people. And, he did a few things that we didn't think would have worked. If he had done what we thought we should have continued to do, I reckon we would have three-peated.
Yep.
But we didn't. And, you know, as they say, c'est la vie.
Well, you got two under your belt anyway, Mike, and unfortunately we're out of time. But the story continues, obviously, beyond that. Maybe we'll have to get you in for a part two sometime.
Sure, totally.
But we appreciate you sharing some of your stories. As I mentioned, your singlet's been retired now. You're a Hall of Famer. You're the inaugural captain of what is now the most successful, in many people's eyes, professional sporting team on the planet. So to say you set the wheels in motion would be an understatement. So thank you so much for coming in and chatting to us. It's been an absolute pleasure, so thank you. You've been listening to Inspiring Stories here on 882 6BR. Don't miss out on the little moments because the little things are everything. We look forward to you joining us again next time as we unearth another inspiring story.
You're listening to Inspiring Stories for Bowra and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments, because the little things are everything.